They are elected by you. I am elected by you. I'm constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
They didn't want one person, one man to have all the power like a king.
We show by our work that free people can govern themselves.
You can't pay lip service to the Constitution without obeying it.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federal Society. Welcome to Necessary and Proper. This episode features audio from a Constitution Day debate held by our Augusta, Georgia Lawyers Chapter on the Commerce Clause, which asks the questions, is everything commerce? And what are and should be the limits of congressional power under the Constitution? The event featured discussion from Professor John Baker, a visiting professor at Georgetown Law, and Professor Thomas Crocker, professor of law at the South Carolina School of Law. The panel was moderated by Judge J. Randall Hall, who is the chief judge for the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Georgia. Please note that because of technical difficulties, what follows is only a partial recording of the discussion. Still, we hope you enjoy it.
Nice to see all of you here today. It's a great opportunity for us to be here and to celebrate Constitution Day. Our discussion, rather than debate, but it's framed as a debate, but our discussion today is going to have the following format. I wanted to make sure you all understand before we begin. 8 minutes each for the first round introductions and arguments, then 5 minutes each for the second round, 4 minutes each for the third round, and then a 20-minute question and answer session. I'll be the timekeeper, and I will try to enforce that to make sure that we keep moving forward. It is truly a pleasure to be here in front of all of you today on this special day. All right, let's begin. Congress is a body with limited and enumerated powers. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3 of the United States Constitution provides that Congress shall have power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. For many years, the Supreme Court struck down laws relating to mining, child labor, agriculture, and the national minimum wage as unconstitutional because they were outside of Congress's enumerated powers. Those rulings were reversed in the late 1930s and early 1940s. That's an entirely different discussion, with a series of decisions applying a much broader understanding of the commerce power. This interpretation reached a high water mark in the case of Wickard versus Filburn in 1942, where the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that a farmer growing wheat on his own land to feed his own livestock could nevertheless be regulated through Congress's interstate commerce power. Since World War II, the size and reach of the federal government has greatly expanded through the creation of laws and programs covering an increasing number of subject areas. The common constitutional authority cited for this expansion is the Commerce Clause. With this background in mind, I would now like for you two to debate the following proposition. The commerce power under the Constitution gives Congress broad and wide-ranging legislative authority. Professor Crocker will begin by advancing the proposition.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much for having me here today. It's a real pleasure to be here, to be part of this conversation, and to be part of Constitution Day. Which is, we're all in this conversation, we're all in agreement the Constitution is quite a an amazing achievement that our republic has advanced and developed and holds dear. The question here is, how do we understand one aspect of the Constitution, the Commerce Clause power, and the kind of power that it assigns to Congress? So, one thing we all will agree on is that the federal constitution establishes power for the federal government by enumerating it. The contrast between enumerated powers and assumed powers is the what exists between the powers of the federal government and the state government. So at founding and with no debate, just widespread agreement that states have what's called the police powers, the powers to do legislate on behalf of the health, welfare, and morals of their citizens. And they don't need specifically enumerated powers to do so beyond what their state constitutions afford, but nothing from a federal constitution. But Congress, by contrast, only has that power which is specifically given to it in the Constitution. For that matter, the federal judiciary only has that power which is specifically given to it by the Constitution or specifically delegated to Congress to provide for the federal judiciary. The president only has that power which is specifically delegated to the presidency by the Constitution. And so there's this contrast. And so why this arises as an issue is that whenever Congress enacts law, it has to point specifically to a source of power that it has to enact the law. So if you want to say, hey, Congress, we'd like you to fix this problem, they can only fix a problem through legislation if it falls within one of their powers. The Commerce Clause power has grown to be one of its most important sources of legislative power throughout the 21st century and throughout the 20th century. And there's a reason why the Commerce Clause power is so broad. In short, commerce is king in our society. Because we've decided to make everything, many of our activities entwined with commerce, then it naturally developed that Congress has a power that has grown with the scope of our national economy. So in the 18th century, when the country was getting going, when the Constitution was ratified, we did not have a highly integrated national economy, nor did we have a sense of economy that we now have. Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations was only published in 1776, which is often cited as sort of the handbook, the Bible, the beginning of a modern capitalism. So the idea that we would have and grow to be a highly integrated national economy was not yet something that was even on the horizon yet. And so as the country has grown, as it has developed, commerce has become king. National economy has become one of the most important features of our lives. Those of you, all of us, can remember just 10 years ago, an economic downturn, that what happened in Vegas did not stay in Vegas. So subprime mortgages that were bundled into collateralized debt obligations and sold to investors were capable of tanking the housing market in Columbia, South Carolina, or Augusta, Georgia. So something so localized as possession or ownership of a property backed by a mortgage in somewhere like Las Vegas, which is one of the epicenters of subprime problems, didn't just stay in Las Vegas. What happened in Vegas spread to the whole country, and that's because of this highly integrated economy. As a consequence, Congress has the power to regulate broadly, because so many things that touch our lives also touch the economy, are also part of commerce. Is this power unlimited? Is it the same as a state police power? No, there are limits. And the court in under the Chief Justice Rehnquist more recently began to set some limitations to what had been an ever-growing power of Congress from the New Deal period of the 1930s until the 1990s. And in a case called Lopez, Chief Justice Rehnquist set a limit saying that it has to involve substantial economic effects. So Congress has the power to regulate the instrumentalities of commerce, so the very things of it, the channels by which commerce flows, waterways, railways, highways, as well as things that have substantial effects on the economy. And so with that background, what Chief Justice Rehnquist did was solidify the case that Judge Hall mentioned in the introduction, Wickard v. Filburn, a case that is about localized activities having substantial effects on the national economy. And so let me talk just for a minute about Wickard v. Filburn. It's a case from 1941. It involved the Agricultural Adjustment Act, which was one of the New Deal legislation that the New Deal Democrats had passed with overwhelming popular support at the time. I think in 1936, after this was passed, the New Deal Democrats controlled 76 senatorial seats. Overwhelming popular support for the New Deal legislative program. And something like 335 seats in Congress, I think it was. I may be off by a few there. But overwhelming popular support. What the Agricultural Adjustment Act enabled and what the litigation in Wickard v. Filburn was about the power of a federal agency to be able to set limitations on how much wheat you could grow. So farmer Filburn in Ohio decided not to abide by the 11.1 acres that he had been provided as his allotment for how much wheat he could grow. He instead grew 23 acres of wheat. And as a consequence, his yield was something like 230 bushels of wheat above his allotment. And so sometimes Wickard v. Filburn is cited as, look, this farmer can't even grow his local wheat for his own home consumption. The amount of extra wheat he grew was enough to be 44 one-pound loaves of bread a day for a whole year. So on the first idea, the sort of idea sometimes advances if this was the federal government telling you about regulating your tomato plant in your little patch in your backyard. Not exactly what's at stake here, though there's a case that we can talk about in a moment that might be closer to that. And so Farmer Filburn, the reason why Congress has the power to tell Farmer Filburn how much wheat he can grow is that every aggregate individual wheat grower, their production goes into the national price for wheat. And so if Farmer Filburn cheats and Farmer Jackson cheats and Farmer Crocker cheats, then we have a glut in the supply of wheat. Prices are down. And as a consequence, we have a failure, a market failure, effectively, for local farmers. So as a consequence, Congress can get to the localized economic activities that a farmer Filburn is engaged in, even though it's local, they can get to that activity as a feature of regulating the national economy, regulating commerce. I think my first time.
Well, there's actually much that we agree on, and so some of my points will be nuanced more than direct confrontation. Congress does have a broad and wide-ranging power, but you can't ignore the text in understanding that power. It is not that the power has grown. It is that commerce has grown. Power has always been stated in a broad term. Many people who consider themselves conservatives think that the Constitution is supposed to be, quote, strictly construed, in a sense that they use the word strict to mean narrow, as opposed to literal. And Justice Scalia always said, I am not a strict constructionist. He said the same thing that Marshall said, and that was to reject strict construction and to give the words in the Constitution their full meaning, but not beyond their meaning. So the commerce power, as it was enacted, could still be interpreted today as Marshall interpreted in Gibbons, but it has not been, and I'll get to that and explain what happened. But second point related to this, Tom said that we are a different nation than they anticipated. Commerce has taken over. This was anticipated by the Federalist. It's in the Federalist, in Federalist Essay number 11 in particular to start with. The big difference between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, who after the Anti-Federalist laws became the Jeffersonians, is related to the nature of this new republic. Hamilton and others saw it as a commercial republic. And that's what Federalist 11 is about. This will be a commercial republic. That's very different from the anti-federalist Jeffersonian view. The Jeffersonian view was the agrarian republic. They had two different ideas of what commerce was all about to begin with. For the Federalists, it meant creating not merely a passive commerce, that is agricultural, but an active manufacturing commerce. And as you probably know, Hamilton on the one side and then Madison joining Jefferson on the other side, they split as to what the nature of the Union was going to be. And this affected fights over tariffs and other things. It affected the war between the states. All of this had an impact. If Jefferson had won, we'd look a lot more like Switzerland. We'd act like the Swiss. We're different. As George Will once said, we all love Jefferson, but we really follow Hamilton. This is a commercial republic. Fortunately, the founders included the anti-federalists, and their strength was always at the state level. So local government, state government, often tilts towards the anti-federalist side of things. Nevertheless, commerce has expanded. And as commerce expands, Congress's power will expand not because the text has changed, not because the Supreme Court has given it a new construction, although it did, and I'll get to that, but because commerce has grown. And when you read carefully, not only the text, but you analyze Gibbons, you'll understand why this is the case. Notice that in the text, it is Congress can regulate commerce with foreign nations and with Indian tribes, but among the states. We may say among because there are multiple. Well, there are many Indian tribes. Among is a superintending power. Again, read the Federalist. It's about a superintending power. Superintending is different from other types of exercise. The anti-federalists were in favor of Congress having more power over commerce, but what they wanted to do was simply to change the what we would call tariffs and trade barriers at the borders of the states. But that's not what the language says. Moreover, it wouldn't have worked for many reasons that we don't have time to discuss. So when you go in, Marshall looks at the text and he says, is it commerce? Is it among the states? And did Congress regulate it? What? It? Commerce. So what was commerce? My colleague and longtime friend Randy Barnett has done a great article on this and very much supports the view of Justice Thomas that at the founding, commerce meant trade and exchange. And in Gibbons, we had the steamboat. The steamboat facilitated the trade and exchange. Moreover, there was a special provision that expanded admiralty jurisdiction to cover not only the admiralty, but to cover navigable rivers. Marshall, in a later case, Wilson Blackbird Creek case, talks about whether it's a navigable river. Today, the EPA doesn't understand these distinctions. You know, a puddle in your front lawn is not a navigable river, and it doesn't give you the authority over this. So those are some of the problems textually. How much time do I have? 2 minutes. Okay, let me see if I can hit a couple of things. We don't have time to go into it, but much of the, there were distortions in the text before the New Deal by the court and by a conservative court. I mean, Hammer versus Dagenhart is a bad case. But it really goes back to the progressives. The key case is the lottery case. Why? Congress got it right. Court got it wrong. The lottery case did not prohibit gambling or lotteries. It prohibited the movement of lottery tickets from one state to another. As Randy Barnett says, the Commerce Clause includes the power to prohibit. And this had to be the case. Why? The states gave up the control over their state borders vis-a-vis other states at the time, only one state in the union had a lottery. And of course, that was Louisiana. And that lottery got 93% of its income from the other states. And the other states are saying, wait a minute, we outlawed lotteries. And Louisiana's taken all this money from us. We want it stopped. Congress only stopped it. Supreme Court came along and said, that was a good thing to do. Lotteries are immoral. Progressive court, progressive Congress. Members of Congress said, hey, the court has said that if we do good things, it's okay under the Commerce Clause. And woof, that's where it started. Actually, long before the New Deal. And the distortions, especially in criminal law, commerce was used as a hook. It wasn't that there was a regulation of commerce. It wasn't even that there was an instrument of commerce. It was the fact that you were riding on a train, taking a woman from one state to another. That was sufficient in terms of the white slave traffic case. I'll come back and finish.
So a point of agreement, I think that's a very good point to make about the text of the Commerce Clause. The assignment and enumeration of powers is complete when the Constitution was ratified. So the power that Congress has is power to regulate commerce. And that, in one sense, you could say that the meaning does not change. But what is commerce, and what are the occasions in which Congress might have the opportunity to exercise that power? So even during an emergencies during the New Deal period, in a case called Home Building v. Blaisdell, the Supreme Court, it's not a Commerce Clause case, it's a substantive due process case and a contracts case, but the court made this point very clear that emergencies do not increase or create power. Emergencies just create the opportunities in which existing power can be exercised in new ways. And I think the point is, and the new ways is my paraphrase, not the court's language, but in allowing Minnesota in that case, the Minnesota legislature to reset some of the conditions of mortgages in order to save the housing market in Minnesota, what the court was recognizing is that there were occasions in which constant existing sources of power might be used in new and creative sorts of ways to address new circumstances. And I think that's the story of the Commerce Clause. The text may not have changed, whatever commerce in fact does mean. I'm not so sure trade and exchange is precisely the whole of the story, though it is certainly part of the story. But given the fact that this assignment of power is constant, the occasions in which it's going to be used change. And they change because of, as we agree on, because economy has grown, commerce has grown over time. So the question is the scope of its application to new circumstances. So an older understanding of the scope of the Commerce Clause, which is what we'll call the pre-New Deal meaning, and the post-Gibbons v. Ogden. What makes Gibbons v. Ogden significant is that it was Chief Justice Marshall who penned that of Marbury versus Marshall, our first great Chief Justice, served on the court for 30 years or so, give or take a few. And his understanding of the scope of commerce is generally regarded as being fairly broad. But in between that, during an early 20th century period, the Supreme Court in a series of cases that includes one called Hamer v. Dagenhart, which involves North Carolina's allowing child labor contrary to the Keating-Owens Act, which had outlawed the transfer of goods in interstate commerce that were produced with child labor. We can get into the specifics of how that was defined, but for our purposes, with child labor. And so one of the issues that arises in an integrated national economy is are real economic considerations. One might be the possibility of a race to the bottom. We here in Georgia and in South Carolina, we can put this kind of humorously, we love our kids and we don't want them going to work too early. But the North Carolinians, they don't. But they're going to have a competitive advantage with pricing because one of the things you might do by employing children is get cheaper labor, and therefore, even despite our different, under our police power, our moral stance with regard to whether it's appropriate to employ children, we might be forced by the competitive pressure of North Carolina's laws to change our laws. And the power to regulate commerce among the states, surely whatever else among means, it includes the ability, to put this in modern economic lingo, to solve collective action problems between the states. So that if we would like to set a baseline that disallows effectively North Carolina from cheating or from going below a baseline of what decent society thinks is reasonable, that North Carolina, Georgia and South Carolina should be protected in our ability to protect our citizens and our laws rather than forced by the power of the marketplace to do something contrary to our wishes. Hamer v. Dagenhart was overturned in the New Deal period, and federal law that allowed the setting of basic minimum wage laws and minimum age laws was upheld as part of Congress's commerce power, in part as a recognition of the importance of the avoiding a race to the bottom and an ability for Congress to solve collective action problems among the states.
He says they're supposed to avoid a race to the bottom. That's not true. That's forms of federalism. One is cooperative federalism. Germany. All the states have to have the same rules. European Union. All the states have to have the same rules at certain times. Not this country. Congress has the power to make things regular, but we have competitive federalism. These do compete one against the other. Various ways, tax subsidies, tax evasion. How do you both protect the other states who don't want to follow the federal labor laws of one state and yet allow that state to operate? It goes back to what Congress did and understood and how they read the Commerce Clause in the Lottery Act. Don't declare the action within the state law. You simply bar that from going outside. It is one thing to say you can't use child labor anywhere. It is another thing to say you can't products produced by child labor outside the state. This is not an endorsement of child labor. It is an endorsement of self-government at the local level. And when other states effectively express their disapproval of what this state is doing, it's likely to have a persuasive effect. But if it doesn't, as Madison said in Federalist 10, the whole point is to isolate. Oh, but that's what it really meant. That avoids the race to the bottom. It protects the other states. But it doesn't expand beyond the text the power.
So, this is a good point. Congress is not required to avoid race to the bottom issues, but it is allowed to when there is widespread agreed upon need for national regulation. So, we could say that Congress, there's all kinds of things that Congress, if it so chose as a consequence of popular political support that it could regulate and ways in which it could regulate, that it can also at the same time allow the states, it can not do that regulation and allow the states to experiment. So federal law through the Controlled Substances Act sets a schedule that gives the legal status of all narcotics, those that you can go to Walgreens or CVS and buy over the counter, those that you need a prescription for, those that are in experimental stages, and those you're not allowed to buy on the street corner or anywhere else. And so the Controlled Substances Act goes as far as regulating the tomato plant or the marijuana plant that you might attempt to grow on your back deck. And so there's a case called Raish in which a woman for medical marijuana purposes wanted to grow her own plant and was busted by the feds, not California agents, for this, prosecuted. And the Supreme Court in a 6-3 opinion upheld the scope of Congress's Commerce Clause power to apply to that single marijuana plant that Ms. Raich was growing on her back deck. And the reasoning it used for that was a claim that Congress can reach purely localized activities that are not in themselves part of commerce if doing so is necessary to achieve a comprehensive economic regulation of a market. And that can include a black market. So even though Ms. Raich is probably, unlike Farmer Filburn, not going to do very much economic activity with her single plant, it'll probably be consumed mostly by her, or, and here's where the slippage happens, her and her friends, right? Congress could reach that activity because it was a necessary element to a comprehensive regulation that Congress undoubtedly had power to do so. The interstate market in drugs is an interstate market. No one denies that Congress has the power to regulate. And it got there in part by also adding another feature of Article 1, Section 8, I think it's paragraph 18, the necessary and proper clause. After listing things like the Commerce Clause power and many other powers that were specifically enumerated to Congress, the Constitution throws in a catch-all and all those things that are necessary and proper to bringing to fulfillment the foregoing. I don't have the exact language, but the necessary and proper clause. And what the court, and particularly Justice Scalia in his concurrence in Raich, pointed to was one way you could justify these purely incidental local non-economic activities as part of a comprehensive economic regulation was to also appeal to the necessary and proper clause as adding power to what Congress has under the Commerce Clause power. And so as a consequence of this, the scope of what Congress may choose to do is primarily restricted by political, the voting box of what we want it to do. When you add an expanded understanding of the role of commerce in our lives, therefore the power that Congress has to regulate that commerce, and when you add the sort of added benefit of the necessary and proper clause is sort of like a kicker to the Commerce Clause power that even Justice Scalia recognizes.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article 1 initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/Article I. That's fedsoc.org/Article I.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.